This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The AIDS epidemic has inspired some deeply felt and very affecting art. My guest John Corigliano's First Symphony memorializes friends he has lost and reflects on friends he is losing. New York Times music critic John Rockwell described the piece as anguished, hysterical, and deeply moving. It addresses a terrible crisis of our time and also manages to make impressive sense on abstract aesthetic terms. The symphony was commissioned by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It premiered in March of 1990 and has since been released on compact disc. Corigliano also composed the opera The Ghosts of Versailles, which was commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera. It was the first opera premiered at the Met in 25 years. Corigliano's father was the concertmaster of the New York Philharmonic from 1943 to 1966. This is the opening of Corigliano's First Symphony, with Daniel Barenboim conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. When you were given the commission by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, at what point and how did you decide to dedicate the symphony to friends who had AIDS?
Actually, it was just as I was ending my 3-year residentship with the Chicago Symphony, and I was about to start on writing the piece that I was asked to write. Sir George Scholte and I discussed this, and he thought I should write a concerto for orchestra because he had done my clarinet concerto, and he thought I wrote virtuosically for the orchestra. And I had mixed feelings about it, but I was kind of set on doing that. And just as I was about to start in the spring, my closest friend of over 30 years, a pianist and musician friend who was indispensable to me as a friend and also a musical confidant, was diagnosed with pneumocystis. And it was a great shock to me. And I felt at that time that I had to do something about the loss of so many friends. And the combination of that and having recently seen the quilt, the Names Project, as it was on tour, and being very affected by the idea that one could memorialize friends in a way that was both intimate and vast, both of those images came to mind, and the idea of a symphony then was the natural outgrowth of this.
Now, the first movement is the movement dedicated to your pianist friend. Can we mention his name?
Yes, we can now. Sheldon Shkolnick, because the piece is dedicated to him. See, he lived to and through the performances and died a week after the premiere. And until about 3 weeks before or 2 weeks before the premiere, he didn't really go out and no one knew he had AIDS. And so in the program notes of the original performance, I left his name out. In fact, all the names of the participants of the in terms of the symphony, because he really didn't want anybody to know he was sick. When he went to the concerts and met all his friends at the Chicago Symphony and they embraced him, and he really made his peace with that. And at the last performance, I said, Shelley, because he said he loved the piece so much, I said, can I dedicate this to you? Will you put your name on it? And he said, yes. At that point, things changed. So now I don't mind mentioning his name because he was proud to be associated with it. And he acknowledged that he had this disease and was dying and, you know, made his peace with it. And so I can say it now.
Before that point, did he know that in your mind the piece was already dedicated to him?
No, it was very schizophrenic because what happened was I started writing this piece after he came out of the hospital because, you know, one always recovers from these first bouts and was on AZT. And what happens when you start taking AZT is called an AZT high. You feel very optimistic. You look wonderful. Your T-cell counts go up. You function well. You feel healthy. And you're denying, in a sense, what's really going to happen, which is extremely appropriate. And Shelley lived in Chicago, and I lived in New York and also a country place in upstate New York. And that's where I wrote this movement. And that summer, I remember talking to him on the telephone and hearing about his adventures. He was the funniest person in the world, and he always told things in a way that had me, you know, hysterical. He was just so great, and imitations and sense of humor. And there he was, the old Shelley, going to, you know, Ravinia and Grand Park and telling me adventures with musicians and funny concerts he'd heard. And I would leave laughing with him on the phone, hang up, and go on with his memorial piece. In no way would I let him know I was doing that because it wasn't appropriate. He was denying appropriately his disease. In fact, I think I told him about his part in the 3 weeks before the premiere, which is 2 years later. He knew it was a piece about AIDS. He knew friends were in it, and I'm sure he's a super smart person. I'm sure he knew he was in it. But when we got to the point in the first movement where the solo piano came off stage, I stopped talking to him about that movement, finished it, and went on to the second movement and talked about that and the third movement and the epilogue and never mentioned the offstage piano, the references to him, and finally had to tell him.
Let me ask you to explain the offstage piano that it comes directly out of your friend's own interests and tastes.
Well, you see, Shelley was a great pianist, really a great pianist and composer, also musician. And when I wrote the first movement, I wanted to, it's subtitled Of Rage and Remembrance. I wanted to portray the fury that one feels in general when one loses or is losing a person one loves and can't do anything about it. And secondly, the rage of how this really came about through governmental inattention and, you know, that sort of neglect that led this disease to become so far-reaching as it has now become. So there's a lot of rage in it. But then the remembrance part was specifically in terms of Shelley. And I wanted to pick something that personified him. And Shelley was a wonderful pianist, especially of turn-of-the-century kind of, I don't know how to put it, that nostalgic music in the early parts of the century that were Rachmaninoff and Gadovsky and those wonderful composers wrote, which exploit the piano in a way that no other age has ever done. And a piece he always played since he was 5 years old was the Tango of Isaac Albéniz as transcribed for piano, retranscribed for piano by Leopold Gadovsky. So since he played that piece all the time, just as Horowitz used to do Traumerei after his recitals, I took that piece and used it as a means of remembering him and situated an offstage pianist who would play the piano and play this exact transcription and float in and out of the orchestral texture as a memory. Now, that in general was made to be the same pianist who plays on the stage. The pianist would walk off and on the stage. But in the actual premiere and therefore in the recording, something rather special happened, and that is that as Shelley got sicker, certain friends became aware of this. One of them, his friend and a pianist he greatly admired, Stephen Huff. And Stephen's manager called me about a month before the premiere and said, "We know you have an offstage piano in tribute to Shelley. Can Stephen play this offstage piano for him in tribute to him?" So I asked the management, and they said, "Sure, that would be great." And he came, played the 32 bars of offstage piano, and was never seen on stage, and did this, a man who's played many concertos with the Chicago Symphony on stage, as a tribute to Shelley, who was incredibly touched when he found not just his role in this piece, but the fact that Stephen wanted to do this for him.
That's a lovely tribute. Let me ask you about the second movement of your symphony. Who is this dedicated to?
Well, I don't mention the other names because two reasons. One is that it's dedicated to Shelley, so of course he becomes the major participant. And the other is that they're personal names, and I feel as though in a strange way this piece is a symphony and it's a piece about people. And the more the names become important, the less the idea, the abstraction of the tragedy becomes important. So what I say in general of these people is this is an executive in the music industry that was very beloved. And the person in the third movement is a friend who is an amateur cellist. And then there are a bunch of other people in the third movement that also are remembered. This friend of mine, who was an amateur musician, became very loved as a member on the 57th Street, we call it, the music industry. He also had a wild sense of humor. He was extremely brilliant, funny, urbane, and the tragedy of AIDS for him was that he died of AIDS dementia, which is madness, which is losing all that incredible mind that he had. And when he had it, no one knew he had it for the 2.5 years that he was coping with it. I never knew he had it. I went out to dinner with him. He was funny. And only in the last weeks did we find out that because he was in the hospital insane, that he was dying of insanity.
Tell me why this second movement is a tarantella.
Well, you talked about the personal part of this piece in terms of music. That's true. What happened to me is just like Shelley had his piece, which I didn't write, but which he always played. There are other parts in this symphony that do have to do with remembrances of my own, things that I wrote for these friends. And the second movement is that case, one of those cases. The tarantella, because it's called a tarantella, the original tarantella was written for this friend of mine in 1970, which is 15 years before he died, as part of a series of piano forehand pieces that I was writing for friends of mine who were not professional musicians to play at home. As you know, Schubert's forehand music, and in the 19th century, many, many pieces were transcribed for piano forehands to play at home. And the last movement, the tarantella, was written for this friend of mine who also loved to play at home. And I wrote it at that time thinking of it as a jolly tarantella, as we think of ba-dum, da-dum, ba-dum, 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 bum, ba-dum, ba-dum, that kind of high-spirited 6-8 dance that just skirts along and makes you feel like jumping up and down. And that was a wonderful experience, and I enjoyed it, and I wrote the piece, and that was the end of it. Now, many years later, after AIDS dementia has claimed the life of this friend of mine, looking back on it to write a symphony, I looked at the tarantella again. I also looked in Grove's dictionary and wanted to find out more about tarantellas and found out that there's a legend that tarantellas were originally performed in town squares in southern Europe during the summers in the Middle Ages and Renaissance by little bands that toured from town to town, and it was because people went mad. They thought it was because they were bit by the tarantula spider. And in their madness, these bands performed these dances, and they danced to the madness, and the idea was the dance got faster and faster, and either they got cured or they fell dead. So the tarantella has a much more ominous history than the jolly tarantellas we hear in Mendelssohn and so forth.
My guest is composer John Corigliano. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Composer John Corigliano is my guest. I want to switch briefly to talk about your opera, Ghosts of Versailles, which was premiered not too long ago, a few months ago, at the Met. It was the first first opera to premiere there in 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard about the opera, which it's an opera that refers to a lot of European operas, a lot of classic European operas, I was wondering why would an American composer who has this chance to write this big American premiere, why it would be so referential to the European operas? So maybe you can explain that.
Well, there are two reasons. One is that this is a celebratory piece of the Metropolitan Opera centennial, and it was the opera that they commissioned. And the Metropolitan Opera in New York is the only international house of history of our country. I mean, you know, there are other opera companies in this country that are large scale, but I would say the Met is the great international house and has the history of premiering operas by Puccini and things like that. I mean, really a history. So I felt the history of opera was embodied in the Met. And there's another reason. I think that opera, as performed at the Met, is basically historical. And I feel that somehow I never feel it works as well, the kind of Americanisms or modernisms that go into operas when they're performed in a house like the Met. I feel as though that is musical theater. And if I wrote a piece for musical theater, it would be a different kind of piece entirely, but I wouldn't write that for the Met.
Did you have a nervous breakdown while writing the opera? It's such an ambitious form to write. I think, you know, if you write an opera and survive, that's pretty good.
Well, I had several nervous breakdowns. My librettist had his nervous breakdown. I had my nervous breakdown. I had my spastic colon. Composing is very difficult for me. It always has been, and it always will be. So I always get awfully tied up in knots when I write music and very insecure. The process is usually one of, well, it starts out with guilt, and then I get a commission, and then fear takes over.
Wait, guilt? Guilt?
Well, when I'm not composing, guilt begins the process.
I see.
Then I accept a commission, which is something I try to put off as long as possible, and that gives me a deadline, and then fear takes over. Now, once fear takes over, then I have to go into the fear mode of trying to get over my inadequacies to write a piece of music. And that's a long process for me. I mean, getting started is the worst, and getting into a piece where I feel I have material or an idea or concept that's worth doing, that takes an awfully long time. And then near the end, there's elation when it finally is over with and I feel I have a piece and the performance has happened. And then I relax a little bit and reward myself and take off, and then the guilt starts again.
And your father, John Corigliano Sr., mm-hmm. was a musician, violinist with the New York Philharmonic. He joined the orchestra in 1935, then became the concertmaster. Did he used to get nervous when he performed? Was he an anxious performer?
Yeah, he was. He was tense, especially because when he played, when I heard him the most, he was playing as soloist with his orchestra, the New York Philharmonic. And he was put in a bit of a different position than most soloists, because if you look at a performer like Heifetz in his day or Itzhak Perlman in today, well, they play a concert every 3 days. I mean, they're playing the same concerto over and over again, traveling from city to city. If it doesn't go well in one town, it'll go well in the next one, and they certainly have gotten used to the idea of playing that piece in front of an audience. Now, with my father, he played a concerto every year, and he'd practice the concerto, and he'd get ready for it, and then he'd go on stage that Thursday night at the Philharmonic and have to face his orchestra as a soloist and the New York critics, and it was tough. So he had tension, but he surmounted that tension brilliantly because he was a great violinist. But I saw him go through it, and I guess that's part of why the idea of music is a somewhat tense experience. I feel like I'm standing naked in front of, you know, thousands of people, and of course millions of people with the critics. So you really feel a sense of exposure and having to do your best.
Your mother was a pianist and music teacher, yes?
Yeah. In fact, she lives in Florida. She still plays the piano, and she was a wonderful pianist. She played my violin and piano sonata with my father, and it's a devilish part. She accompanied him in all his concertos, but she never wanted to play in public. She was too nervous for it.
Nervous family.
Yeah, I think so.
Did you ever study with her?
Yeah, I took 2 or 3 piano lessons with her and gave up, and that's why I never studied anything, because you know, it's very hard for a parent to teach a child. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of, you know, oh, so you tell me that, but, you know, you wouldn't tell that to someone else or something like that. And this was, you know, way back in public school time. And so I never really learned to play the piano or any other instrument. I fake things. I can get around the piano, but I can't play a Mozart sonata, that kind of stuff.
So I guess that's one of the reasons why you turned to composing.
That was partly it. I was really fascinated by things that were happening in American music. I remember how I got interested in the first place, and that was that when I was in high school, my mother actually offered me an alternate of two birthday gifts. One was a Contour chair, and the other one was a hi-fi set, monaural in those days. And I always wondered what had happened to me if I ever took the Contour chair. I'd be a much more relaxed person. But I took the hi-fi set. And so I had a 15-inch speaker, you know, on those Klipsch cabinets that go against the wall, and the beginnings of LP records. They were just coming out in the early 50s. And I bought a Capitol full-dimensional sound sample disc that had all these various cuts from various Capitol records. And one of them was the gunfighting scene from Billy the Kid of Copland.
Mm.
And before then, I didn't know anything about contemporary music. I wasn't exposed to it. I had no idea about it. And I was playing that over and over again, mainly because of the bass drum, which was fantastically recorded, which would shake my whole house every time I played it. And I loved it and listened to it. And then right after that, there's this wonderful honky-tonk dance in 7/8 with the piano and some very strange spacings that only Copland would have thought of. And I was absolutely amazed that he was taking simple chords and rhythms and making them sound so new to me. So I went to the piano and started trying out these wonderful rhythms and spacings. And, you know, just like the opening of Billy the Kid is just an open fifth and an octave. But the way he spaces it, it just doesn't sound like any other composer. And how he did that was the thing I was finding out by ear by playing the piano. Then I went and get more records of Copland, and I went to Stravinsky and other composers, started getting scores out. And that's really how I got interested in composing, through the LP record.
Now, I want to flesh out your resume a little bit. In addition to composing classical music, you've written commercials, you've produced pop records.
Mm-hmm.
You used to be, I think, an associate producer for the Bernstein Young People's Concerts on television.
Right.
But you also wrote an alma mater for Midwood High.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Can I get you to sing a few bars?
Oh, God, no. The reason I can't, twofold. One is I don't remember the words because I never remember any words. And two is it's too big a range for me. But I'll tell you this much. My high school teacher, Mrs. Tillis, I just spoke to her yesterday, and she's exactly the same as when I was in high school in the early 50s. She has the same energy. I wrote that piece for her, and I also, she really, really got me inspired to be a composer because my parents were very discouraging about my going into music, and she was not. And I wrote her a piece called Fern Hill, by the way, on Dylan Thomas, which was one of the first pieces I ever wrote, and the chorus that she did with her chorus, and since then it's been done with big orchestras and choruses. So in a sense, Midwood and the school I went to in Brooklyn was the beginning of my musical life, mainly because of her.
Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
John Corigliano's First Symphony is on compact disc on the Erato label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.